bit into the philosophical background behind the opinions that the Rambam brings on in Perek Gimel. I mean, the last time we went basically through the different opinions on creation, as you recall, the Rambam first presents the sheet of the opinion of the Torah, Teras Moshe, the world's created ex nihilo, from nothing. And then the Rambam presented as his second theory of creation, the Platonic theory of creation. And the third theory of creation was the Aristotelian theory of creation. I mean, creation, I'm saying creation, actually, the Platonic and Aristotelian theories of creation are not theories of creation. At least, Aristotle's not a theory of creation, it's a theory of non-creation. And Plato is a theory of creation, non-creation. Somehow, both creation, non-creation. In any case, I wanted to focus a little bit on the theory of Plato. The fact is that the Rambam, at first, on page 299 in the Schwartz edition, says Hadei Ashniyah he das kol misha shamanu es shimoi v'reino es devora b'ben philosophian, which seems to imply that the Platonic theory of creation is something that was filtered through other writings of the philosophers. But then at the very towards the bottom of the page, beginning of what's the third paragraph in the Schwartz edition, he says ha'ikar ha'klali shosia zos hi mashiantilcha zos v'asi gam das shel ha'palton. This is the theory of Plato. Okay, and actually, in fact, he says Aristotle presents this. Ma'amin shashamayim mitavim v'kalim, that the heavens are created. Right? V'chein timtza eshitas b'furash b'sifra shel Timaeus. So the Rambam is the Rambam lists explicitly his source, the Timaeus. While there is a bit of a discussion of exactly what original sources the Rambam had or what he had in translation, but the Rambam, if we can believe the Rambam says is that if we look in Timaeus, we can actually find, he says, the Shitasu B'Mefurash, the explicit theory of Plato is in the Timaeus. So what I did was I Xeroxed part of the Timaeus. It's one of Plato's very famous dialogues. I guess we'll send it out. Those of you in the audience who don't have the Timaeus in your libraries will try to send it out. But I thought maybe we'd go through the Timaeus a little bit and see exactly. In the Timaeus, Plato presents his theory of creation. Actually, his theory of creation, cosmology, theory of science. The Timaeus is one of the central dialogues of Plato. The text in front of us is of course, an English translation. I do not read ancient Greek, but I understand it's a good translation. I can't tell, but there seems to be a decent translation. And so what we'll do is we'll begin on page 13. As you know, that this dialogue is a dialogue between Socrates and Timaeus. Okay? So that's Steigen Plato. Okay? There's a little alumnus here, too. Okay, now, Socrates. Okay? Page 13. Sex Socrates. I guess, actually, there's ways of tracking this. It's 27. Maybe 27 is the original page number. 27, I guess, between B and C. So Socrates says, apparently I'll be getting a complete billion banquet of speeches in payment for my own. Very well then, Timaeus, the task of being our next speaker falls to you. Why don't you make an invocation to the gods, as we customarily do? So Timaeus says, that I will, Socrates. Surely anyone with any sense at all will always call upon a god before setting out on an adventure, whatever it's important. Okay, this is basically a Greek philos haderech. In our case, we're about to make speeches about the universe, whether it has an origin or even if it does not have, or even if it does not. And so, if we're not to go completely astray, we have no choice but to call upon the gods and goddesses and pray that they above all will approve of all we have to say, and then in consequence we will too. Let this then be our appeal to the gods, to ourselves, who has appealed to make sure that you learn as easily as possible, they instruct you in my subject matter for us in the way that best conveys my intent. So basically, this is absolutely, okay. They're asking for lahavdil elef avdolah, is what's called siyata d'shmaya. Okay, now, let's go on. Now, says Timaeus, as I see it then, we must begin by making the following distinction. What is that which always is and has no becoming? And what is that which becomes but never is? In other words, there's a chiluk. There's something which is called that which always is. It doesn't become something. It always is that which it is. And there's something which becomes but never is. What's the pshat is never is? Never is means it's never something that's not changing. It just becomes something. In other words, something which is what it always was, or always was what it is, that's something which, in other words, has a, right, which is rooted, right? And in other words, there are things which always were, they're stationary, you know, they're invariant. And there are certain things which become, because they become in the view of Plato, they don't really have any stationary or absolute identity. We'll see what this means. So, Maisa, Plato says that there's an afkamina between things which always were and things which become. Why? The former, in other words, the things which always were the way they are, is grasped by understanding. In other words, basically these things can be understood intellectually, and which involves a recent account. It is unchanging. In other words, according to Plato, things which don't change can be understood intellectually, they can be understood by the seichel. The latter, things which become and therefore have no stationary or permanent existence, is grasped by opinion. In other words, what's opinion? The Maaseh, we saw a little bit of this in the Rambam, and the Rambam speaks a little about this in when he speaks about theoretical reasoning as opposed to opinions in the first part of the Mirna Vuchim, then the Rambam speaks about that there's what's called theoretical knowledge, right? And then there's something which is called opinions, no, Tov and Ra. He speaks about the Chet of the Marishan. But basically, Plato says things which become, which means are not invariable, things which are not always the way they are, but change, are grasped by opinion, which involves unreasoning sense perception. In other words, it cannot be understood intellectually, but rather we perceive them, but there's no intellectual substance to them. That's Plato's distinction. It comes to be and passes away, but never really is. Yeah.
What does that mean?
What?
What does that mean? Any thought process is intellectual.
No, but for example, if I have something that always is, actually we'll see a little bit later in Plato, something which always is means, and has certain has a certain intellectual structure, like a mathematical structure. But something which becomes, in other words, doesn't have a permanent structure, so you can't, something which doesn't have a permanent structure, you can't describe it mathematically. This is when you look at a triangle. A triangle is a mathematical structure. A triangle is always the same. So you can describe it mathematically. You can analyze it, you know, it's user-friendly. But for example, if I would, let's say, draw a triangle, you know, in the sand, you know, I can't really describe, in other words, it looks, it resembles a triangle, but in and of itself has no abstract structure. It's just sense perception. I might say it's patterned after a triangle. In other words, if I say this thing that I drew in the sand with three sides is patterned after a triangle, I can speak about the triangular structure of it. But the thing itself in the sand, in and of itself, right, in other words, doesn't contain inherently the mathematical properties of a triangle. That's what he's saying.
Why not?
What?
Why not?
Because when I say it's if I want to describe
the mathematical idea of a triangle is not
the math, but it's an abstract idea.
Right. So the thing in the sand, as much as it's
I'm saying it resembles a triangle, but the thing in itself is just a drawing in the sand. It's just a sense perception. In other words, when I describe something by a model of what it is. The model is stationary. The drawing in the sand is just a drawing in the sand. It has, in other words, if one is described as a triangle, I have to refer to the idea of a triangle and try to sort of like, you know, to apply it to the drawing in the sand. But the drawing in the sand in and of itself, right, unless I resort to the theoretical abstract model of a triangle, it in itself is nothing. I just perceive something engraved in the sand. That's what Plato was saying. I mean, we're going to develop this thing. In other words, the physical world just changes. All I do is perceive it. When I speak about ideas, the ideas are abstract ideas, right, which always remain constant. Something that remains constant, I can analyze it, I can describe it precisely. But something which is in flux, right, I can never describe precisely, I just sort of like perceive it. That's what Plato was saying. Okay? Okay, now, it comes to be and passes away, but never really is. Now, what do I mean never really is? Now, the fact is like this, Plato speaks about something which is and something which isn't. Now, I'll go a little bit further. Now, Ryan, I think it's worth it to actually speak a little bit about like this. In other words, this is an English translation. I think maybe this is a little bit your problem. Is it fall like this? You see, in Greek, when I say something is, what does it mean something is? So in other words, in English, when I say something is, I say something exists. In other words, in English, there's a notion of it called absolute existence. For example, I say the table is, means the table exists. So that was your question. What are you talking about? The thing in the sand exists. Whatever it is, it exists. Now, the Greek scholars, from what I understand, claim that in the Greek language, the word to be is not an absolute term, really, but it's a predicate. In other words, there's no word, separate word in the Greek language that something is. When you say something is, it means something is X. So, for example, in Greek, there's no word to say the table exists. When I say the table is, it means the table is, let's say, square. In other words, in the English language, there's something called absolute existence. Something exists. If I said like the table exists, so I'm not telling you, I don't say what the table is, I just say it exists. Like I said, the table doesn't exist means like there's no table, it doesn't exist. But in Greek, there's no verb which means the table just exists. The verb in Greek means the table is something else. So really, now what I'm saying is actually it's actually watered down, but there was no separate word for exists. So when I say something is like this. If something is always is what it is, it means you can only assign one predicate. For example, something is X, like the table is square. So that means it exists. You know what the table is. In Greek, the table is means the table is always in the same state. But for example, if a table can be square or round, let's say you have a table that shifts from a square table to a round table, so in other words, in Greek, you would say the table isn't. What do you mean the table isn't? The table isn't in one state. It's either round or square. This is after research in the National Library of Hebrew University. This is the opinion of the Greek scholars of the last 30, 40 years. That in Greek, it's very interesting, something is lost in translation. In other words, something which always is means it is. Something which becomes, which means it shifts from one state to another state, that means it never is. But the meaning of never is means it never is in any one state. It's only one state, another state. That's the Greek language. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, we're not speaking about exist, absolute existence. We'll see that in a little while. But I'm just saying is there's no separate Greek word for exists, unqualified existence, or you would call in philosophy, you know, extension versus non-extension. That's what I'm saying. You have to, today, when people study Greek philosophy, it's not only important the idea is the Greek language is different than the English language. And the language is very important in the way we frame ideas. Okay? Very good. Now, so it's very, very good. In other words, if something exists, which means it's always in one state, I can describe it. But if something is not in one state, it goes from one state to another state, I can't give it an absolute description. It always goes from one thing to another thing. Now, of course, today in modern mathematics, I could write an equation in time. But the Greeks didn't have that. Whereas today, in modern physics, there's something called invariables, invariances. In other words, I have a dynamical equation which describes a process, and it's invariant under certain things, like, for example, invariance in space is called conservation of energy, or invariance in time is called something else. Or, for example, invariance under Poincaré transformations is called relativistic. But I'm saying is the Greeks didn't have things like that. So in other words, basically, I can describe something only if it's always in one state. For example, I can describe a triangle. If I have a right angle, I could use the Pythagorean theorem because I can describe it. What happens to the triangle, sort of like every 5 seconds, it curves around. So I can't use the Pythagorean theorem. So that's a little bit what Plato's saying over here. Something which has a fixed state, I can describe it. Something which goes from one state to another state, I can't describe it because it always changes states. So that's called it isn't. By the way, Daryl Hagav, what's a consequence of what I'm saying? A consequence of what I'm saying is that the Greeks, according to this opinion, the Greeks have no concept of creation ex nihilo. Because you can't say something doesn't exist. You can only say something is in one stationary state, or something is in not in one stationary state. But the Greek language does not allow, at least for a specific term, which says something exists absolutely and something doesn't exist. Okay, that's a little kind of what I'm saying.
And the transformation into another shape, but that will be creation ex nihilo.
It'll just go from one state to another state, but it doesn't not exist in absolute term. Creation doesn't mean it doesn't exist in absolute term. It'll go from one state to another state, but it's not ex nihilo. Ex nihilo means it comes from no being. It's not in any one state. That's the pshat. Okay, now, by the way, Derech Agav is a...
Because there's no term for non-existing.
According to what I'm saying here.
Everything has to be described either as ephemeral or stationary.
Right, that's it. That seems to be the pshat. Now, look, what I'm saying is I'm leaving out a lot of details, but you know what? Certainly that's a way of many Greek scholars understand this sentence as meaning that. Okay, now. Okay, goes on Plato, or Timaeus, right? I mean, who's Timaeus? Timaeus is Plato speaking. Socrates, I think, is like the, he's the con man here or something, whatever it is. This is Timaeus speaking. Now, everything that comes to be must necessarily come to be by the agency of some cause. In other words, when something becomes, it comes because of an agency. For it is impossible for anything to come to be without a cause. By the way, Derech Agav, we see something very interesting over here, that only things which become have a cause. But things which are always the same don't seem to have a cause. They always were. Okay, so there he says, we're continuing, I'm going down to page 14. So whenever the craftsman looks at what is that which is always changeless, and using a thing of that kind as his model, reproduces its form and character, then necessarily all that he so completes is beautiful. But worry to look at a thing that has come to be and uses as a model of something that has not begotten, his work will lack beauty. Okay? Now, what is Plato here? Plato's here saying the thing. When a craftsman, right, let's say for example, a person makes a sculpture. So he's going to use something as his model. So, says Plato, when a craftsman makes something, what's going to be his model? His model's going to be something which doesn't change, which always is. Only if you use your model, something which always is, can you create something which is beautiful. But if you use your model, something which is not always what it is. So therefore, what you're going to create lacks beauty. Because according to Plato, the only things that really have intrinsic beauty are things which can only be described intellectually, which are things which don't change. So, for example, when you create the world, or when you create something, you could use, you're going to create something based upon a model which is unchanging. And that, therefore, that which you create will be a duplicate, or you know, some type of an expression of something which is unchanging, and therefore will have beauty. But for example, if you look at something which changes, which you know doesn't have any intrinsic, you know, structure, and you create something based upon that, what you're going to create is something which is not beautiful. It's going to be nothing. Okay, now, so now we have like this. Okay.
What do you mean by beautiful?
We'll get to that.
You're saying a sculpture of a still life is not beautiful.
No.
A sculpture of a triangle is beautiful.
Yeah. Right. Right. Beautiful means it has. According to beauty, is something which can be intellectually apprehended in a certain sense, compared to an intellectual form. We'll get to this. Now, okay. So he goes on and says, now it's the whole heaven. Uran is a world order, cosmos. Let's just call it by whatever name is most sensible to give in context. There's a question we need to consider first. This is the sort of question which begins with inquiring into any subject. Has it always been? Was there an origin from where it came to, from which it came to be? Or did it come to be and take its start from some origin? It has come to be, for it is both visible and tangible and has a body, and all the things of that kind are perceptible. And as we have shown, perceptible things are grasped by opinions which involve sense perception. As such, there are things that come to be, things that are begotten. In other words, if something becomes something, so it itself does not have inherent structure, but it's perceived by what's called what he calls opinion. Furthermore, we maintain that necessarily that which comes to be must come to be by the agency of some cause. So first of all, something which comes to be can be grasped by sense perception, and therefore has opinion, but is not subject to what's called reason. And number two, there must be a cause which makes something to be. Now, I have underlined, because this is actually, now to find the maker and father of the universe is hard enough, and even if I see that to clear him to everyone is impossible. Here this is a parenthetical statement about a Kodesh Baruch Hu. In other words, he says, I'm not going to speak about God right now, because I'm not going to convince anybody of what I mean. And so we must go back and raise the question about the universe. Which of the two models did the maker use when he fashioned it? When the person who made the universe, whoever this person is, what model did he use? Was it the one that does not change and stays the same, or the one that has come, or one that has come to be? In other words, when whoever made the universe, he created, obviously the universe that we have has come to be, right? It's come to be. Now the question is, what model did he use? Did he use a model which never changes, or did he use a model which changes and therefore never is? Well, if this world of ours is beautiful, and its craftsmen good, they clearly looked at the eternal model. So this is Plato. If our universe is beautiful, so for sure the creator of the universe based his construction of the world on a model which is never changing. But if what is blasphemous to say is the case, then he looked at one that has come to be. But if you say our world is not beautiful, so he must have used as his model something which comes to be. Now surely it's clear to all that it was the eternal model he looked at. So says Plato, for sure God looked at the eternal model. God, by the way, is my insertion. For of all the things that have come to be, our world is more beautiful. Says Plato, you see the world is beautiful. So it must be the creator of the world looked to an unchanging model. Now, the fact is that this is the Shitas HaRambam. It turns out that this concept in the Timaeus, the Rambam describes in Parak Vav of Chelek Sheni. The Rambam speaks about Malachim, angels, and of course Malachim are Devarim Sichliim, their intellects. And then, says the Rambam, I'm in the Schwartz edition, on page 279. First of all, the Rambam says Malachim exist, they're intellects which exist. And on the third paragraph in the Swatch edition, on page 279, the Rambam says, Akan inan abedabrim ela ala malachim, ashehem sichli nevdolim. They're separate intellects. In other words, nevdolim means they're separate from the physical world. Ki ain't terasena machisha, She's alamanigas abetzias bemtzoyis habalochim. In other words, our Torah does not deny that a Kadosh Baruch Hu directs the world or puts the world in motion by means of separate intellects. And says the Rambam, Chazal speak about this. For example, it says in the Torah, Nase Adam b'tzalmeinu. Who's tzalmeinu? The Sichlim ha-Nivdolim, Malachim. U'dvorav hava ne'odah. Let us go down. Let's go Pamay Shemala. Shem b'loshin rabin. Loimar to say, and this is a Chazal, well actually it's not a Chazal anywhere, Kosh Baruch doesn't do anything until he looks at Pamay Shemayla. Now, Mispalya ni al divrei mistakel. So the Rambam, the Rambam is puzzled by the language of Chazal, which says that God looked at these things, right, and then he did something. Shirei benusa chazer atzbo oimer apalten, because Plato says the same thing. And God looks at the world of forms. He's going to say this a little while, Plato. Then comes the Metzius. We see clearly over here the Rambam is using a concept from the Tinius. That when God creates the world, what he does is he looks at those things which are what? Never change. You will see in Plato these are the forms. And then he creates the world. So, for example, it says, the Rambam brings several chazals, Bereishis Rabba, etc. Basically, Istakel, I know, Istakel Bereis Abar Alma. Mine says the same thing. Kodesh Baruch, that's, according to the Rambam, the concept of Kodesh Baruch looked at the Torah, it created the world, right, is actually a Platonic concept, which the Rambam probably got from the Timaeus. That in fact, actually, Kodesh Baruch looks at the eternal, unchanging forms, and with that he created the world. And that's what he says. And that's why I'm on the side of my page, on my Gilyon here, my Timaeus, I wrote here, Meirin Nevuchim, Chelek Beis Perek Vav, and page 2279 in the Schwartz edition. That's what he says. Now surely it's clear to all that it was eternal. The eternal body looked at for and so there was, the world is beautiful. So if the world is beautiful, so it follows out that when God created the world, he looked at these eternal, unchanging forms and created the world. Okay? Now, so he says over here, since these things are so, it follows by unquestionable necessity, I'm now on page 15, that this world is an image of something. What do we get? The physical world is an image of something else. Now, in every subject, it is of utmost importance to begin the natural beginning, and so on the subject of an image and on its model, we must make the following specification. The accounts we give of things have the same character as subjects they set forth, etc., etc. Okay, so he goes on and says that basically is that our universe, which God created, is an image of some perfect forms, which, according to Plato, are never changing. Okay? And we see that the Rambam, in fact, agrees, except the Rambam makes a disclaimer, so you don't get nervous about that. There is a distinction, says the Rambam, between us and the Greeks. On page 282, the Rambam says, in the second paragraph, which is the last paragraph of Parag Vav, on 282 of the Schwartz edition, says the Rambam in conclusion, is Bayin Eifel Ketzin Huva Bikol Tzad, Shemashmos Malachu Maizik Kol Shu, Vishikol Mara Malachu Rak, Bamara Nevua, Vahed Lamatova Shalamasik. Ain Eifel Gam Bamashi Tzina Rista begins there, Dovachat. There was nothing that Aristotle says about these things, which is Cholik on the Torah. I don't think it's really Aristotle, I think it's really Plato, whatever it is. What?
Aristotle has his own.
I understand that. I think it's really Plato, whatever. Ela Adova Shabo Cholik Aleno, Bechol Zehu, Shumamin, Shakal Devama Elo Kedumin. In other words, Aristotle believes in all these forms of things which are eternal. In other words, they always existed. V'shem kach b'schayvim meni zalim. It was, they have to be. V'anachu ma'aminim shekol zanevah. We believe that all these things are created. V'shakel bo'os ha'sichlim ha'nivdolim. Because Baruch Hu created the sichlim ha'nivdolim. V'dos b'chol golem koyef teshuk aleihem. And he put them into the sphere, the celestial spheres. V'shakel bo'os ha'sichlim ha'nivdolim, etc., etc. But as das Torah emes al chiddush ha'olam. In other words, the Rambam is saying that the only difference between us and the Greeks is that the Greeks believe that these eternal forms always existed, and that we believe that these eternal forms were actually created. Now, the mice, how are they created? Well, that's really what the Rambam speaks about in Parakeet Beis, where he says the Kadosh Baruch Hu thinks thoughts, and probably when the Kadosh Baruch Hu thinks thoughts, what he does is he creates these sichli and nivdalim, and the basis of this, he creates the physical world. Okay? Is that right? That's clear. Okay, now, I want to go a little bit further, okay? So this is, let's go further in the Timaeus. So I'm now on page 15, on line 29D. Socrates. So Socrates says, bravo, Timaeus. By all means, we must accept it as you say we should. This overture of yours is marvelous. Go on now and let us have the work itself. Okay, now the Timaeus is going to go into details. Here the Timaeus has basically stated the basic postulates and the basic ideas. Now he's going to go into the details. In other words, basically what the Timaeus is going to do is he's going to describe these abstract mathematical forms and how they are the building blocks or the theoretical basis of constructing the physical world. Now we're not going to go through the entire Timaeus, but we'll go a little bit through the next page or so, because this will be very, very much relevant to the to what we're speaking about here. Now, so he says like this. He says, very well then, says Timaeus, very well then. Now why did he who framed this whole universe of becoming framed? Oh, why did God create the world? Okay? Let us take the reason why. And I have here my Gilyam, this is Mor Nevuchim, Chelek Gimel Parak Yud Gimel. He was good. And one who is good can never become jealous of anything. And so being free of jealousy, he wanted everything to become as much like himself as was possible. In fact, men of wisdom will tell you, and you couldn't do better than to accept their claim, that this, more than anything else, was the most preeminent reason for the origin of the world's coming to be. The God wanted everything to be good and nothing to be bad, so far as that was possible. And so he took over all that was visible, not at rest, but in discordant and disorderly motion, and brought it from a state of disorder to one of order, because he believed that order was in every way better than disorder. Ah, very good. So first of all, we have here several yesodos. Here we see that Timaeus is saying explicitly that creation is not creation ex nihilo, but creation is coming, is basically going from a state of disorder to a state of order. Okay? So, the fact is, if you want to point to a Makor in the Rambam over the Platonic theory that there's a disorderly state of matter, or it's matter, disorderly matter, from which a Kadosh Baruch Hu fashions the world, it's going to be this statement of the Timaeus. That basically, matter always exists in a disorderly state. And that God, from this disorderly state, creates the world. Now, the fact is, why did God create the world? It's interesting.
God is just negative entropy, basically.
Yes. But more so, lehetiv. That's how we see the Mekubalim.
Why is there entropy now, then, according to Timaeus?
What?
God made the world, made everything ordered, and then ever since then it's been getting...
We have to go back, let's go further than 10 years. Mm-hmm. This is just the beginning. First of all, we see that there's a reason. In other words, what does Plato have to say? Like this. Plato has to answer, why did God take something in disorderly state and make something ordered? The answer is God is good. God wanted to create something that was like himself. Or put it this way, what is orderly is better than what is disorderly. Now why is orderly better than disorderly? Because somehow God is ordered. So in other words, it's interesting, because it's a little while that Plato here is like very much, like that's the Kabbalah dick a little bit. In fact, as we're going to see, that Plato's the beginning of Kabbalah.
You're back to perfect ideals.
Right, lehetiv.
Good.
Lehetiv. Now, by the way, the Rambam denies this. The Rambam Chelek Gimel, the Mor Nevuchim, Perek Yud Gimel, says you can't say what was the reason of the creation of the world. You can't say there was a reason. We're going to go into this another time, but the Rambam Shita is that you can't say why the world was created. But Plato says there's a reason it was created. Lehetiv, of course, Baruch wanted to do something good. Doing something good is basically being what God is, means orderly. And therefore, God took this orderly state and made it into an order state. Now, Platinius here becomes very, very much more and more steeped in Kabbalah. Now, it wasn't permitted, nor is it now, the one who is supremely good should do anything that but what is best. No, when you do something good, you do that which is the best. Okay? Accordingly, the God reasoned and concluded, on page 16, that in the realm of things naturally visible, no unintelligent thing could be as a whole be better than anything that does possess intelligence as a whole. And he further concluded that it's impossible for anything to come to possess intelligence apart from soul. Now look at this. That's a high. Incredible. It's Mamish Kabbalah. I'm here in my Gilyon, the Gilyon HaKodesh, Nefesh HaChaim, Shah Beis, Perakei, which actually I quoted in the Goyen Shir, actually, 2 days ago. Guided by this reasoning, he put intelligence in soul, and soul in body, and so he took the universe. Basically, the universe is a living being. It has a neshama, and it has an intellect. He wanted to produce a piece of work that would be as excellent and supreme as his nature would allow. This then, in keeping with our enlightened account, is how we must say divine providence brought our world into being as a truly living thing endowed with soul intelligence. Lamaisa, Plato holds that the physical world is alive. It's a living thing. He says that in the next paragraph. The living universe is a living thing with a soul and a shama. Now, that's what the Nefesh HaChaim says. Mila b'mila. That's the Goyen says. Mila b'mila, the Nefesh HaChaim says, actually the Goyen says it, that, we don't speak Kabbalah, this is by Nevuch HaMashiach, but Nefesh HaChaim says, Mila b'mila, in Shal Beis, Perakei, that basically, Kadosh Baruch Hu gave the world a neshama. By giving the world a neshama, the world becomes, has a tzuras ada, and therefore, man, when man does mitzvahs, all he's doing, therefore there's a shir koima, which has a tzuras ada. And that accounts for the fact that man, by doing mitzvahs, his Ramach Evar bin Shasa Gidim, a keneged, the Ramach Evar bin Shasa Gidim of the Shia Kaima of the entire universe, and that's how, by doing mitzvahs, man is able to affect the entire spiritual, physical cosmos.
I have to ask this question, even though it's off topic.
Yes.
For the sake of the video.
Yes.
Are you suggesting that Plato knew Kabbalah? Are you suggesting that Kabbalists just took Plato? Or just both things were covered with the same idea?
Look, I can't say that Plato knew Kabbalah.
Crazy things have been said.
But you want to know something? First of all, Reb Tzadik says, in a famous quote, which we know from... No. I think maybe... I know. Reb Tzadik says... Daniel Einstein has it on his... we did that in the... In the think tank, that Greek philosophy is the chitzonius of Kabbalah. Reb Tzadik. What? Yeah. In other words, that's what he says.
Meaning?
He said, meaning then what? That if I take Kabbalah and express it philosophically, right? Philosophically, without, you know, reference to, you know, the revelations of the Arizal, I try to explain it philosophically. I come up with concepts of Greek philosophy. That's what Tzadik says.
So this really is Kabbalah, just a different sort.
But I answer, I'm going to claim no. First of all, Tzadik is very medayik when he says the chitzonis of it. When he says chitzonis, say it's hainu hach. But we'll speak about that. But in any case, there's no question about it. You see, what's interesting is, there's no question about it, that according to Plato, the universe is a living thing. It has a soul. It says, he calls it, the living thing comprehends with itself all intelligible living things. In other words, the whole world is one living thing which comprehends things. Why? Because God wanted to create a world like himself. So he gave it a soul. We gave it an intellect, which he put into a soul. And therefore, the universe is a creature. It's a living thing. That's the opinion of Plato. Now, by the way, now Derech Agav, this is shocking. This concept is mentioned appears in the Kuzari. In the Kuzari, in Maimer Revi, which no one ever learns. People only learn the first two Maamorim. Maybe coach the third. No one gets the end of the Sefer. But in the fourth Maamor, the Kuzri says, how can we assign, the Kuzri says, the Chava says, Yudah Levi says, how can you know, given the fact that Kosh Baruch Hu is not describable, how is it possible we describe him in anthropomorphic terms? So he says the reason is, because he brings from the Greek philosophers, as is known, the entire universe basically is a living creature. So because of that, we can describe the entire world, and we can describe God in human terms, because as the creator of the universe, right, all that is basically has human features. In other words, God acts through nature. So by describing nature, we're describing a living thing, we're describing a person. Now, what I want to do is, I didn't really want to get into this so much in particular, because actually this was actually, the fact is that the Rambam for sure argues on this. The Rambam for sure argues on this. In fact, the Rambam would probably call this Avodah Zarah, idolatry. Even though the Rambam calls man an Adam Katan,
Can't they have idolatry?
Yeah. I think the Rambam calls Avodah Zarah. Even though the Rambam calls men Olam Katan, I don't think that, the Nefesh Chaim there wants to claim the Rambam was a big Makubo. The answer is that he obviously was not a Makubo. And the fact is that from the very, very beginning of this thing which Plato says, the Rambam disagrees with it. The Rambam says you can't look for a cause for the universe. The Rambam says, the Rambam explicitly in Chelek Gimel Perek Yud Gimel says, you can't say why God created the world. And I think the Rambam is probably saying that because if you say why God created the world, then you're forced to what? To take step A, B, C, and D, and you end up with a world which actually is a physical human being which has intelligence. And the Rambam says the only two things that have intelligence says are what? Are God and man. In other words, according to the Rambam, the only things which have intelligence is, are the planets. The planets have intelligences. The physical world doesn't have intelligence. But man has intelligence. The Rambam would deny that, but Rambam says animals don't have seichel. They might have what seichel?
But that's not really a theological.
No, I claim it is.
Imperative for the Rambam.
No, I claim it is.
Why?
Because
you believe that? Basically, what he said was that the bottom of the intelligence ladder is physical matter, so therefore it stops there. It ends at physical matter.
But that's going to be important.
But it's not, it's a scientific statement, it's not a theological
statement. I disagree with that. I think that for the Rambam to say the entire universe is one living thing, if I said the entire universe is one living thing, then what I'm doing is I'm ascribing intelligences to the physical world, and it could possibly that would be in other words, if I say the entire world has a neshama, I would say that's a type of immanence the Rambam would oppose. In other words, for the Rambam, the Rambam's negative theology would deny that. In other words, for the Rambam. I could say about God that he has intelligence. That's in chapter 68 and 69 of the first part of the Maariv Avochim. But I can only ascribe intelligence to something, to a soul, which is not physical. To describe intelligence to something physical, which means I'm describing a divine quality, to something which is physical, and I think according to the Rambam, I'm going to consider it to be pantheism of Venezuela. What is negative theology? Negative theology means what?
The spheres have intelligence, and man has intelligence.
That's okay. That's fine.
Why is that fine?
That first of all, that obviously doesn't. That doesn't violate negative theology. For the Rambam,
it was important for the Rambam that God is completely separate from the spheres and from man also.
No. But you see, there's a violation of negative theology, quote unquote violation. In chapter 68, the Rambam says that. God's intelligence is like man's intelligence, except that man's intelligence is sometimes active, something passive. God's intelligence is active. In other words, the Rambam's negative theology has holes in it. Holes in it means there are some attributes of God which you compare to man, right? Rambam says God's essence is his knowledge, his intelligence, and his will. In other words, the Rambam's negative theology is not absolute. What allows us to compare God's intellect to man's intellect is because intellect is something which is not physical. But if I were to say that, for example, that intellect is something which is physical, that, for example, that the physical things of the world are endowed with an intellect, then basically I would be taking something which is not physical and making it physical. And I think that would be a kind of immanence, which actually the Rambam considers to be an example of paganism, of pantheism. In other words, according to the Rambam, you could say man is created b'tzelem Elokim because you're speaking about man's intellect. But once you take what's called God's soul and place it within the physical world, basically you're left with something like a priori or a medieval Balatanya, and the Rambam would consider that to be, in fact, actually, I think the Rambam would consider that to be a Vedazah. That's what I claim. For that reason, that's my cheshbon, for that reason I want to claim that the Rambam would not say something like this. Now, that which the Rambam calls men oilam katan, and with this I very respectfully disagree with Rav Chaim Volozhiner, is not because the Rambam held that the entire physical universe was actually endowed with a soul and a body, but basically that man is capable of conceiving and conceptualizing the world, therefore man is called oilam katan. In other words, the Rambam takes the soul of God, which put it once upon the time of the universe, and basically places it all on man. That's why man is called the Olam Katan, because man is capable of conceptualizing all of creation. He has an intellect similar to that of God. But to endow the world with a soul, to give divinity to the physical world, in my opinion, would be of a nizama. Derek Agav, I want to say something which is also point two. We see something very interesting in Plato. There's nothing special about man. In other words, in Plato, there's nothing special about man. The whole world is one intelligent being. Man is only part of the physical world. There's nothing special about man. There's nothing special about man. In the Rambam, it's clear there's something special about man. All of the theoretical and spiritual weight is thrown upon man. But the physical world is something that's beyond the physical. The Rambam makes a very important distinction between the spheres, which are intelligences, and the physical world. So, in other words, this made me go off on a tangent, but, you know, I think this is worth considering. What I want to claim is that the Rambam stops here. And the Rambam stops here by saying in Chelek Gimel, Perek Yud Gimel, basically that you can't say that there was a purpose for creation. Because once you say there's a purpose for creation, right, that means that the world, the physical world, contains some type of a beauty, a tachlis, a good, which actually leads us to this Platonic conception of the physical universe, and the Rambam, you know, will reject this completely. That's what I want to say, but you know what, it's, you know, we... So that's my opinion on these things. But in any case, now, why is this different than Kabbalah? That's another shiur already. I don't think this is the Goyim. Maybe it's the Nefesh HaChayim. I don't think it's the Goyim. Or put this way, if you're asking me what the difference between the Goyim is in the Sara Kalalim, those of you who, you'll look in Perek Yud, Sara Kalalim, the Goyim says that not only is the world has a, the Goyim will say the world has a Tzuvas HaAdam. Plato doesn't say the world has a Tzuvas HaAdam. It's an intelligent being. It's not Tzuvas HaAdam. For the Goyim, the world, in other words, the Goyim is still placing man at the center of the universe.
What tzura does it have about
Ephraim? What?
What tzura does it have about Ephraim?
At least in this thing, it doesn't have a tzura, but it's not of a person. It might be an animal or something. It's intelligent, I don't know. It's an intelligent thing, but it's not a person. It's not a tzura sa'adam. In other words, the difference between Greek philosophy and Jewish Kabbalah is that Jewish Kabbalah is still centered upon man. The universe, even if I want to say it has some type of an anthropomorphic, intelligence, whatever it is, the patsuf of the metaphysical world, still have what's called a tzuras ha'adam. We spoke about the patsuf of Adam Kadmai. In Greece, there's nothing special about man. That's what I would say. But I think this is going off on a tangent. Okay? Anyway, so like this. Now, so what do we have is the following. Let's a little bit summarize what we have over here, because it's important. So what do we have? First of all, we have like this. First of all, we have very, very explicitly that Plato says over here on 30A, or 30A or 30B, page 15, he brought it from a state of disorder to one of order, because he believed that order was in every way better than disorder. Now, that's one of my proofs. When I said earlier, when Plato says that which always is and that which becomes never is, is not speaking about existing absolutely. That which always is means is always in one state. That which becomes and never is means it never is in one state. But the Greeks have no, in the Greeks, there's no concept of not existing. Non-being is not a concept, it's not a possibility. Because if that was true, so say, say something doesn't exist. You see, non-existence in the Greeks just means something which doesn't have a permanent state. But not existing completely is what? Is not it's not an option. So because of that, when I say something isn't in the Greeks, it means it isn't in a permanent state. And therefore, what is becoming? Becoming means going from one state to another state. So therefore, for the Greeks, the act of creation is creating from what? From a state of disorder to a state of order. That's the Greek concept of being. But there's no concept, right, of creating from non-being to being. That doesn't exist in Greek thought. And that's Plato's theory of creation.
Yeah. The same as Ramban's theory of creation?
You're speaking about the first Ramban al-Chumash. So, the first Ramban al-Chumash mentions two things. He mentions first B'ya Yesh B'ayin, and then he mentions the Hiyule. The Ramban al-Chumash, the way I understand it, is that he combines both things. First of all, he speaks about creation ex nihilo, that a Kodesh Baruch Hu creates the Hiyule. That's Toyo Vavoyo. And then after that, Kodesh Baruch Hu fashions the world. So for the Ramban, creation takes place in two states. First, Kodesh Baruch Hu creates the Toyo Vavoyo, or he says a Dover Dakas, whatever it is. That's Yesh B'Yayin. And then after that, for the Yesh B'Yayin, right, he creates the world. That's Kodesh Baruch Hu for the Oretz, that's B'Yesh B'Yayin, it's Krishna stealing the Ramban. And then also Toyo Vavoyo, what he created was a Toyo Vavoyo. And then after that, he takes over Vayil and he constructs from that a world which has form, which has shape. That's the Ramban.
According to Timaeus, where did the chaos come from?
Where did the what?
Where did the chaos come from, according to Timaeus?
It always was. It always was.
I mean, that's not unsimilar from the Rambam.
So the difference in
Ramban. No. That's the when the Rambam says. Timaeus.
No, I mean the Ramban is because the Ramban's only objection really was that the matter, whatever matter was that precedes the physical universe, the Ramban says we have to see also as having been created. Like the intelligences, the Ramban says, have to have been created. That's
right.
His main
right.
issue, right?
Right.
The Ramban provides that kind of model.
That's kind of right. But in other words, the Plato understands that the matter in disorder always was. By the way, that's also a proof that when we say always was means always was in one state. Now, Lamai said, what's disorder? You have to say disorder is not a state. Or put it this way, disorder is not intellectually, right. What does it exist means? It means not in a specific state. What disorder means, I cannot intellectually describe it. That's called not existing. Not existing doesn't mean none being. Not existing means intellectually perceiving, understanding something. That's called disorderly state. That's what you have to say that in Plato. Because otherwise, if we speak about non existing, there's no creation ex nihilo in Plato. I mean, there's no concept of that in Plato, and probably not in the Greek language. Now, the notion of creation ex nihilo, by the way, begins with a philosopher, I don't know if it was a Greek philosopher, called Philoponus in the 6th century. That's the beginning of what's called creation ex nihilo, which I think will be the next year. The next year we'll speak about I want to speak about Aristotle, the dispute between Aristotle and Plato. Obviously, there's an important dispute between Aristotle and Plato here. You know, Aristotle doesn't believe in these conceptual forms upon which God created the world. He rejects this. Aristotle says what you see is what you get, and what is.
That's why it's much easier for things to be beautiful for Aristotle.
Right. On the other hand, though, there's no concept of creation. Things are always the way they are. And in other words, the two opinions of creation of Aristotle versus Plato are really consequences of the way Aristotle and Plato look at the world, so I can understand the world. According to Plato, the world is basically a physical thing which has an overarching mathematical or conceptual or theoretical scheme. And according to Aristotle, there is no a priori conceptual scheme. There is the world in and of itself. Okay, I think it's getting late. We have 3 more minutes. I hope that everybody enjoyed this wonderful reading of the Timaeus. Maybe in a few months, if we have a proper grid, we will actually read it in the Greek. Actually, someone in the Hebrew University, when I was looking at this Timaeus, someone peered off of my shoulders with long payas and said that if I wanted and get a group of people together, we could actually read it in the original Greek. I said, oh, that would be beautiful. So maybe we can be, maybe one day we'll be zeichet to read things in the Greek. I mean, after the Sefer Torah, you have to keep the yafes, but you can't buy the shame. I mean, kind of the pasuk. Anyway, next thing I think we'll speak about Aristotle, and then I want to go into the history of creation ex nihilo in science. Then we'll get up to the Rambam. Okay, be well until next time. Keep the faith.